to me. What is this?
I loved that documentary you told me about. It was delightful. Who talks like that?
I'm excited to go on long walks with you this summer. It's like a whole creepy story.
I've given serious thought to what you said. Family is definitely most important. I've been good and gone too many nights to count. I've been up late and baked, and I'd scribble out wacky shit. But never have I come up with anything this bonkers. Dear Evan Hansen, you're the man. Amazing. Life is looking up, way up. I take it back. This shit is brilliant. I'm ready to make a change, all thanks to you.
Why is Evan doing this?
First he plants a letter for me to find. Now he's got my family involved, feeding them lies. Guess what, Mom? The reason I seem different is because this isn't fucking me. My mother takes off her reading glasses, the one she never wanted to be photographed wearing. I never knew how much our trips to the apple orchard meant to him. The apple orchard. Haven't thought about that place in years. Thinking about it now, I have to say, nothing terrible comes to mind. No blow-up fights or traumatic episodes. That's usually what happens when I dig too deep into memories. The worst stuff pops up first. But those orchard trips were pretty uneventful. In a good way. We acted like a normal family. My mother would pack lunches. Zoe and I would roll down that bumpy hill. My father put work aside. Paid attention. Why couldn't that happen more often? Why couldn't we carry that feeling home with us? He says here that when it closed, he felt like his childhood ended. It makes sense when you think about it. That's around the time his behavior really started changing. No. If it's answers you want, Mom, you're digging in the wrong place. That's one thing about my mother. You see, my father is convinced there's only one right answer to every question, but my mother will keep searching forever. She'll try anything and everything. Sounds noble, and maybe it is, but even that approach can start to feel like torture, especially when you're the lab rat. I can't do this, Zoe says. She drops the paper and rises from the couch. Thankfully, someone in my family seems to have a functioning bullshit detector. But she can't escape. Larry hits her with one of his stock questions. How's school?
Amazing, Zoe says. All of a sudden, everyone wants to be my friend. I'm the dead kid's sister.
The dead kid. Me.
I'm sure Mr. Contrell is happy to have you back at practice, my mother says.
You guys really don't have to do this, Zoe says.
Do what?
Just because Connor isn't here trying to punch through my door screaming at the top of his lungs that he's going to kill me for no reason, that doesn't mean that all of a sudden we're the fucking Brady Bunch.
Not the most comfortable thing to hear your little sister say. But actually, I think there's a compliment in there somewhere. Some vindication, at least. Because I've often said, maybe it's not me contaminating the family pond, but the other way around. She storms off. Not much of a storm, in truth. If it were me, I probably would have smashed something. Then, afterward, I'd feel bad about it, but not bad enough to apologize. Or not do it again.
She'll be all right, my mother says. We are all grieving in our own way. Larry knocks back his scotch. My mother returns to the emails.
I feel like I'm seeing a new side of him. He seems so much lighter here. I can't remember the last time I heard him laugh.
I laugh plenty. I laughed plenty. I laughed at how absurdly fucked everything is. I laughed because there's not much else you can do. You can laugh, or you can cry. I do plenty of both, but see, any time my mother got a glimpse of the raw me, she couldn't take it. There'd be so much fear in her eyes. There was love, too. I saw it. But the fear. That's what stuck with me. You catch that look, and it's not like you're itching to open yourself up. No. You shut down pretty quick.
I'm going to bed, my father announces.
Come sit with me,
I'm exhausted.
You know, Larry, at some point you're going to have to start.
Not tonight.
Please.
I suppose this is what I get for building my walls so high. My family never actually knew about my life. Occasionally, I'd reference a friend, going out with a friend, got it from a friend. But I don't think they believed me, especially when I never forked over a name. Even now, I don't like saying his name. I wonder, has he even noticed I'm gone?
I wander upstairs to Zoe's room. I find her strumming her unplugged electric guitar. What she said about me is only partly true. I screamed at her a few times, banged on her door. I never threatened to kill her, though. Does she really believe that? Of course I'd never actually hurt her. It's like that quote, full of sound and fury, signifying nothing. That was me. That was also Shakespeare. Just because I didn't hand in my essay on Macbeth doesn't mean I didn't pay attention. Maybe I paid too much attention. She's on the carpet now, her back against the bed. Her strumming stops. She props her pick in her mouth and scribbles in a notebook. I can't remember the last time I was in her bedroom. We were next door neighbors who just stopped saying hello. I thought she was the clean one. This is chaos in here. Clothes scattered, blurry still life photos from an instant camera, a pile of loose guitar strings, old toast on a plate next to a dirty knife. Lady Macbeth is another famous suicide. There's a line of hers I underlined. Something about how you get no lasting satisfaction from causing destruction. In the end, the only real solution is to destroy yourself. A new sound. Zoe is talking. Not talking, actually. Softly singing.
I could curl up and hide in my room. Here in my bed, still sobbing tomorrow.
She mutes the chord. More scribbling in her notebook. She sings a cappella.
I could give in to all of the gloom, but tell me what for?
She hums while she writes. It's a developing melody. She retrieves her pick, nestles the guitar to her chest like that raggedy bear she used to tote around. Early on, we got along fine. Backseat passengers on the same ride. We'd share beds on vacations, before Larry had his name on the letterhead. We'd all pile into one hotel room. We'd feed the cats under our deck. This was back at our old house. Cynthia didn't want us letting them inside. Diseases, she said. We'd trade Halloween candy. Zoe liked chocolate. I was all about the sours. She'd want to do everything I was doing. Play with my cars and X-Men. Pretend she was a soldier in my army. At some point, though, she stopped fighting for me. Where's the loyalty? The other day at lunch, when Evan and I had that argument, she went to see if he was okay. What about me? Who was checking up on me?
Why should I have a heavy heart? Why should I start to break in pieces? Why should I go and fall apart for you?
I never knew she was singing in here. Now that I'm hearing her, there's no way to unhear. She enunciates each syllable, commanding my attention. A private moment unknowingly shared. There's so much hurt in her voice. Even more of it in her words.
Why should I play the grieving girl and lie? Say sing no requiem tonight.
I wouldn't call it a lullaby.
Chapter 11. Mr. Lansky collects our papers and promises that results of the quiz we just took won't count toward our final grade. It's a relief, considering I could barely concentrate. Mr. Lansky wants to see what each of us already knows and doesn't know about the different states of matter. I'm more focused on what I know and don't know about my own life. What I know. Jared and I delivered a packet of emails to the Murphys on Tuesday. It's now Thursday. What I don't know. Whether the Murphys received the emails. Whether they read them. What they thought of what they read. Whether the emails helped them or not. What they want from me now. I can't even remember what Jared and I wrote. The words arrived in a mad, inspired rush. I handed over my only physical copy to the Murphys. I was going to ask Jared to send me the files, assuming he didn't already get rid of them, but I decided I don't want to see them. I'm trying to forget that they exist, that we did what we did. The bell rings and it's off to lunch. I lag behind my classmates. What's the hurry? Before all of this, I was alone, but I still had a few squeezes left in my tube of hope. Connor Murphy wasn't a part of my daily life. He, like me, existed in the background. Our paths didn't cross, and if they did, neither of us noticed. I was able to sit in the back of the cafeteria, sneaking glances at Zoe and imagining the possibility, however far-fetched, that one day we might be together. Now I don't even lift my head at lunch. I'm too scared to catch another one of her icy stares from across the room. I enter through the open double doors into an onslaught of aromas and sounds. I'm the last one to arrive, it seems, which is fine, because I don't need much time to eat, if I eat at all. My usual table has plenty of open seats. I take one. As I'm sitting down, someone says, "Hey, Evan." The kid seated across from me looks familiar, but I don't know his name. "Sam," he says. "We have English together." "Oh, right. Hey." Sam resumes eating. I stare into his thick forest of hair. Where did he come from? Has he always been here? I've basically gone all of high school as a non-entity. Being acknowledged all of a sudden fills me with a strange and unsettling sensation. Since my eyes are already raised, I keep them up for just a moment longer and take stock of my surroundings. As I feared, I'm getting stared at. But this time not from Zoe. The stares are coming from all over the cafeteria, and not all at once. They're not quite stares, actually, more like brief glances. A head turn here, a peek over there. I lower my head and start unpacking my sandwich. At this point, just the sight of my sun butter standard fills me with dread. When I was working at Ellison Park over the summer, my boss, Ranger Gus, and I would grab lunch at one of the nearby food trucks. My favorite was the Korean tacos. I'm practically salivating right now thinking about those tacos. That, right there, was living. It actually makes me excited for dinner. Tonight is taco night with Mom. I take a chomp out of the flavored styrofoam in my hands. The bench shakes as someone takes a seat next to me. "Oh my God, how are you?" Alana Beck says. "How is everything?" My reaction time in social situations is always slow, but with Alana, it's even more delayed. Her brightness is like the sun reflected off snow. I'm not sure why she's so interested in how I'm doing, but it's nice that she's asking. "I'm okay, I guess." She cringes as if in pain. "You are amazing." "Me?" "Jared has been telling everyone about you and Connor. How close you guys were, how you were, like, best friends." Now I'm the one cringing in pain. "Can an ulcer form instantaneously?" "Everyone is talking about how brave you've been this week," Alana says, her hands clasped, a nun consoling a bedridden patient. "They are?" My voice cracks, and I almost crack with it. I scan the room. Is that why everyone keeps looking at me? Sam delivers a miraculously timed nod. "I mean, anybody else in your position would be falling apart," Alana says. "Dana P. was crying so hard at lunch yesterday, she pulled a muscle in her face. She had to go to the hospital." "Isn't Dana P. new this year? She didn't even know Connor."
"That's why she was crying, because now she'll never get the chance."
Connor is really bringing the school together. It's pretty incredible. People I've never talked to before, they want to talk to me now because they know how much Connor meant to me. It's very inspiring. I actually started a blog about him, a sort of memorial page. I open my mouth to speak, but can't. My heart rate has tripled. A long drink of water barely helps. I didn't realize you were friends with Connor. Not friends, really. More like acquaintances, but close acquaintances. My heart rate drops to merely double speed. He probably never mentioned me or anything, she adds. I can't tell if she's asking a question or making a statement. Either way, my lips are sealed. Truthfully, she says, I think part of me always knew you two were friends. You did a really good job of hiding it, but I totally knew. She leans in. Tell me something.
Tell you what?
The photo everyone keeps posting of Connor, the one where the other guy is cropped out. The other guy is you, isn't it?
She studies me. I'm too frightened to even breathe.
She smiles. I knew it.
Sam smiles too.
I didn't say anything. I didn't do anything, not a nod, wink, or twitch. Hang in there, Evan, she says before departing. I want to be somewhere else. Anywhere else. I gather my lunch and head for the doors.
Jared appears in my path, his arms spread open, welcoming me. I go in for a hug.
What are you doing? He says, throwing me off him.
Sorry, I thought...
I'm trying to show you something, asshole.
He points to his chest. Over his heart is a button with Connor Murphy's smiling face on it. It's that same photo of Connor. Jared reaches into a canvas bag slung over his shoulder and removes an identical button, which he pins onto my shirt.
I'm selling them for $5 each, but you can have yours for $4.
You're making money off of this? Off Connor's... I can't bring myself to say it.
I'm not the only one, Jared says. Haven't you seen the wristbands with Connor's initials on them that Sabrina Patel started selling during free period? Or the t-shirts Matt Holzer's mom made?
No, I haven't. I can't believe people are doing that.
It's simple supply and demand, my friend. Right now, we're at the peak. He pats his bulky canvas bag. I have to move these buttons before the bottom drops out of the Connor Murphy memorabilia market.
He walks away. I call after him.
I'm not wearing this thing.
I can't get the button off fast enough. I toss it at him. As I do, I see over his shoulder the glare of Zoe Murphy. She just watched me tear Connor's button off my shirt and launch it across the room with contempt. Jared saunters off and Zoe takes his place, standing right in front of me.
What's wrong? She says. You don't feel like wearing my brother's face on your chest?
What if I took one of the buttons and stabbed the needle point in my eye? Would that be justice? Zoe scans the room. He would have hated this. And then, returning to me, don't you think? It sounds sincere, like she's seeking my insight. Then again, it could be a test. Probably, I say. There's so much weight in her eyes. I can't decipher what any of it means or what particular shape it takes, but the overall heft of it, the total sum, it's colossal, and I'm staring straight at it. She's about to step away, but her retreat is interrupted. I look down to see what she sees. It's my cast. What's written on it? When I go to check her face, it's too late. She's already halfway across the room, swallowed by the masses. It's an eerie feeling being back in the computer lab. It was only last week when Connor Murphy stole my letter. I wasn't even aware he'd been in the room at the time. I look now over my shoulder, checking who's here. A few kids. I don't see Connor. Obviously, I don't see Connor. He's not alive. You can't see people who aren't alive. Maybe he could be alive right now if I hadn't printed that stupid letter. As soon as I hit return on my keyboard, it's like I started a tragic chain reaction. If the Wi-Fi connection failed and the command never reached the printer, Connor could be alive. If my mother didn't schedule that appointment with Dr. Sherman for that specific day, Connor could be alive. Also, if I never broke my arm, there would be no cast for Connor to sign, and maybe I could have debunked this myth before it hardened like plaster. Considering how far I fell from that tree, I could have broken a whole lot more. I was lucky. That's what everyone told me. I didn't feel very lucky, lying there in the most excruciating physical pain of my life, but I guess I was. I could have wrecked my back, cracked open my head, even worse. Ranger Gus drove me to the hospital. He kept asking me what I was doing up there in that tree. I didn't know how to tell him that I suddenly felt like climbing a tree when I was supposed to be working. I made up a story on the spot, what I hoped might sound better. Something about finding a loose dog on my sweep, how it ran away before I could grab it, and how I chased after it. I thought I could get a better view of everything if I was higher up. "You call me on the walkie," Ranger Gus said. "How many times have I told you that? Anything out of the ordinary, you call me on the walkie." He was angry. There were several instances over the summer where Ranger Gus's sudden shift in tone caught me off guard, and I had to remind myself that as much as he felt like my friend, he was actually my boss. One of those instances was when I tried calling him Gus, without the Ranger part, and he immediately corrected me. "The rules are in place to keep you safe," Ranger Gus said from the driver's seat of one of the park's pickups. "To keep everyone safe, including the park. Seems to me you just tossed all that out the window." He was right. Truthfully, I didn't care one bit about safety in that moment. That's not where my head was. "Look, I know you're in pain," Ranger Gus said, "but if you don't learn from this, then all that pain is for nothing." I didn't mind Ranger Gus coming down hard on me. I was sort of grateful for it, actually. "Did you call your folks?" he asked. Ranger Gus's reaction was better than what I got from my dad. When I talked to him the next day, my dad started telling me about how his older stepdaughter Haley broke her wrist last year. He described how quickly it healed and how Haley was back to playing sports in no time. If he was trying to make me feel better, it didn't work. I would have preferred any other response than the one he gave me. He could have ridiculed me for being clumsy or sympathized with a simple, "That sucks," or he could have shared a story about a bone break that he had when he was little. I definitely didn't want to hear about Haley right then and there. "I left my mom a message," I told Ranger Gus. "I think she's in class." Coincidentally, she wasn't at the hospital that day when we arrived. I remember feeling relieved when I realized that. I haven't spoken to Ranger Gus since my apprenticeship ended. I was with him 5 days a week for 2 months, and now we have nothing to do with each other. I don't know. It just seems sort of messed up. One minute we're a team or whatever, and now he's probably busy teaching a new recruit. I awaken my computer screen. I could send Ranger Gus an email and ask how he's doing, but considering how rarely he's online, he probably wouldn't see my email for weeks. I tried to get him to create a social media profile for himself and the park, but it did not go over well. Ranger Gus is one of those off-the-grid types who thinks technology is ruining society. Besides, if I emailed him to ask about his life, I'd also have to fill him in on mine. That evening, I'm busy trying to bang out some homework before dinner when I notice a new email in my inbox. The subject reads, "Thank you." I open it and realize that it's a message from Cynthia Murphy. The sight of her name nearly strikes me blind. Why did I include my real address in those emails I gave her? I should have made up my own fake account, too. I begin to read. "Dear Evan, we received the package you left. We can't thank you enough for trusting us with these private exchanges. They certainly provide us a view of Connor to which we were never privy, one that we can hardly reconcile with the boy we knew. You mentioned there were more emails. We'd be grateful for whatever you choose to show us and at whatever pace you decide. Reading over these emails is almost like seeing Connor live on, and part of me wants to stretch out the experience forever. I do have one favor to ask. I'm wondering if you have any additional emails pertaining to Connor's unfortunate struggle with substance abuse. In particular, did he ever mention by name any of the people who supplied him with drugs? Would you go back and check? Of course, my husband thinks I'm wasting my time, but I would just sleep more soundly at night knowing you looked over everything and could confirm that there was nothing there." Finally, when will we see you again? Are you free tomorrow night? We'd love to have you over for dinner again. With the deepest love, Cynthia.
The emails didn't satisfy her. She wants more.
This will never end.
Names? Why is she asking me for names? So she can give them to the police? It's definitely not so she can send out gift baskets. No, she wants justice. That's my interpretation of this reading. And when it comes to English skills, I feel, for once, confident. Here's what else I feel confident about. Cynthia Murphy going to the police is officially the worst thing that could happen. On my nightstand next to the waiting pile of college essay scholarships are two bottles. One is full of water, the other Ativan. I swallow one of the latter and down some of the former. I close my eyes, willing the chemicals to course through me. My shoulders slacken and my breath slows as I wait for myself to reset. Okay, this has to stop. I have to make this stop. I'll just tell Cynthia that there are no names. It's the truth. I've started keeping track of truths like they're breadcrumbs that might lead me out of this. But what if it's still not good enough for her? What if she won't take no for an answer? This is a grieving mother we're talking about. This woman lost her son. This isn't a game for her. It isn't for me either. That's it. I can't go on like this. It's time to come out with the truth. The whole truth. It's what I tried to do from the start, but I didn't speak loudly or clearly enough. I'll fix it. I'll go back to their house and I'll look them in the eyes and I'll just do it. I'll confess. You okay there? It's my mom in my doorway. I swear she possesses some kind of superpower for suddenly and inconveniently appearing outside my bedroom.
Yeah, I'm okay. Of course.
That Ativan can't kick in fast enough.
You had a very focused look on your face. She squints, doing her best impersonation of me.
Let me guess. She comes closer. Is it math? That was always my worst subject. I shut my laptop before she can reach it. She stops in her tracks and we share a look.
I was just emailing Jared,
I say, hands shaking.
He had a question about something.
I avoid her eyes and notice that she's wearing her scrubs.
It seems like you and Jared are spending more time together.
She seems relieved.
I've always said he's a great friend for you.
Yeah, really great. Her purse hangs over her shoulder and she's holding her car keys.
I'm proud of you. Putting yourself out there.
Right, I say dispassionately.
Well, I'm leaving, but I left money on the table. She turns to go. Order anything you want, okay?
A sick, swelling feeling mixes in with what was already there. I wish I didn't even care.
I thought we were doing tacos tonight. Looking at the essay questions.
Her eyes widen.
That's tonight. Oh my God. Oh, honey, I completely forgot. Shit.
She bangs her keys against her head.
That's okay,
I say, because, well, what else can I even say? She sits down on my bed and looks at the pile on my nightstand.
You know what? You should go ahead and take a look at the questions without me. And then if you have any ideas, you can email me and I can write back with any ideas that I have. That's better anyway, isn't it? That way you can really take your time.
I nod, ready to be done with this whole conversation.
Yeah, for sure. We can do tacos another night, Evan. We could do tomorrow night. How about tomorrow night?
I can't tomorrow. I'm busy. My mom doesn't hear me. She's looking at the time on her phone.
Shit, I'm late.
I get out of bed. You should go. Those bedpans aren't going to clean themselves.
No, let's figure this out. It's fine. Evan!
I head for the door. I'll make dinner for myself, I say, leaving her alone and late in my bedroom.
Chapter 12. This is the double bed that Connor Murphy slept in. The wooden floor his boots scuffed up. The white walls he did his best to smother. Standing out amid movie and band posters, homemade works of art, and a joke award ribbon that says, I put on pants today, is a close-up photo of a hand with its middle finger extended. The middle finger is painted black with tiny white lettering on it. Only when you press your face up close to the photo can you read what the white letters say. Boo. I'm scared, all right. But I was already scared before I entered Connor's bedroom. Cynthia told me to come up here while she finishes preparing dinner. Apparently, in my panicked state, I arrived an hour earlier than I was supposed to. I offered to stay downstairs with her and help set the table, since she seemed to be doing it all by herself, but she insisted that I go and spend some alone time with Connor. It's almost 80 degrees outside, but inside the Murphy home, I'm shivering. That woman downstairs is about to have her heart broken for the second time, and I'm the one who's going to re-break it. She told me again how much the messages between Connor and me meant to her, how they're helping to keep Connor alive. I can see a new lightness in her tonight, and yet here I am, about to rip Connor away from her all over again and reveal myself to be a terrible, terrible person. I hate to do this to her, but what choice do I have? It's even worse to keep feeding her lies about me and her son. As torturous as it feels to be here in Connor's private space, it's probably the closest I've ever been to the truth of who he was. Besides the obvious differences between his bedroom and mine, my bed is half the size, my floors are carpeted, and my walls are painted light green, there are some striking similarities. Nowhere in this room is a single hint of anything sports-related. I've always felt out of step with kids my age for having zero interest in playing or watching sports. Also, like me, Connor has shelves crammed with books. I see The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy, The Catcher in the Rye, The Great Gatsby, and The Mysteries of Pittsburgh. Some of the stuff I've never heard of, some I have. I see a school copy of Macbeth from our junior year. He's got at least half a dozen Kurt Vonnegut novels. A few have Dewey decimal numbers on the spines. It seems like a contradiction. Connor Murphy in a library. One of the titles I own, Into the Wild by John Krakauer. I saw the movie first and then went back to read the book. It's about a guy in his early 20s who tries to live on his own in Alaska. When it came to nature, the guy knew his stuff. He would have made a superb park ranger. Unfortunately, he ended up committing a critical mistake and perished out there in the wild. It's a weird feeling knowing that Connor and I both read the same book. It's possible I had more in common with him than I have with most kids at school. If the two of us had sat at the same lunch table, we could have talked about other books we've both read, like Slaughterhouse-Five. Who knows, maybe we could have actually been friends. So it goes. One of Connor's hardcover books has no jacket or title. I remove it from the shelf. It's a journal full of sketches. They're bizarre and unnerving, but also intricate and skilled. This one features a man in galoshes holding an umbrella. Rats and spiders are falling from the sky. The ground and trees are also covered in rats and spiders. A caption at the bottom reads, "Critterism." It's kind of funny. Why are you in my brother's room? I practically throw Connor's sketchbook back onto the shelf before facing Zoe. I showed up too early and your mom told me to come up here. Don't your parents get upset that you're here all the time? She asks. I'm not here all the time. I've only come twice. But I'm not about to contradict Zoe Murphy in her own home, or anywhere for that matter. It's just me and my mom, I say, and she works most nights. Or else she's in class. She leans against the doorframe. Class for what? Legal stuff? Oh, yeah? My dad's a lawyer. Oh, I say, scratching my ear. I don't even have an itch, but I suddenly have a very strong urge to scratch. Where's your dad? Zoe asks. Now I'm clearing my throat. Clearing my throat and scratching. Not weird at all. He lives in Colorado. He left when I was 7. So, he doesn't really mind if I'm here either. Her eyebrows jump. Colorado's not close. No, it isn't. 1,800 miles away, actually. Or something like that. I haven't calculated it or anything. Of course I have. She steps into the room and I step back, accidentally kicking a metal garbage can. It might as well be a cymbal, that's how loud it seems to reverberate around us. We stand there awkwardly at opposite sides of Connor's room. The only places to sit are the bed and the desk chair. I make no move toward either. Anyway, your parents seem really great.
Right, Zoe says amused. They can't stand each other. They fight all the time. She comes even closer and takes a seat on Connor's bed. Her rust-colored corduroys hike up just enough to reveal her naked ankles. I try to retreat even more, but there's a wall behind me and I almost end up knocking something off it.
Well, everyone's parents fight, right?
That's normal. My dad's in total denial. He didn't even cry at the funeral.
I have no idea how to respond to this, but that is definitely not something you reveal to someone you hate. Even if she doesn't hate me now, she will definitely hate me later.
Your mom said we're having gluten-free lasagna for dinner, I say.
That sounds really
inedible.
I try not to laugh.
Not at all. You're lucky your mom cooks.
My mom and I just order pizza most nights.
You're lucky you're allowed to eat pizza, Zoe says.
You're not allowed to eat pizza?
She rolls her eyes.
We can now, I guess. My mom was Buddhist last year, so we weren't supposed to eat animal products.
She was Buddhist last year, but not this year?
That's sort of what she does. She gets really into different things. For a while, it was Pilates. Then it was The Secret. Then Buddhism. Now it's Free Range Omnivore's Dilemma or whatever. It's hard to keep track.
Besides my mother's fascination with astrology and arena rock, she doesn't really have any interests or hobbies. I tried to get her to come on a few hikes with me, but she said she doesn't like bugs.
Zoe scratches her freckled shoulder and then leans back with both hands propped behind her. She smiles at me, and my body reads it as an invitation. I look down and try to recall what we were just talking about.
I think it's cool that your mom is interested in different kinds of stuff.
She seems confused that I'm confused.
She's not. That's just what happens when you're rich and you don't have a job. You get crazy.
My mom always says it's better to be rich than poor.
Well, your mom's probably never been rich then.
And you've probably never been poor.
Did I just say that? I feel my face begin to radiate red heat.
I'm so sorry, I say. I didn't mean to. That was completely rude.
She laughs. I didn't realize you were capable of saying something that wasn't nice.
I'm not. I never say things that aren't nice. I don't even think things that aren't nice. I'm really sorry.
I was impressed. You're ruining it.
Oh, shit.
I'm sorry.
Shit.
You really don't have to keep saying that.
I want to. So badly.
She sits up on the bed and grabs a solved Rubik's Cube off Connor's nightstand.
You want to say it again, don't you?
Very much so, yes.
She smiles at me. A real and full smile, the kind Zoe seems reluctant to hand out freely to anyone. And I feel myself bask in it, like I made that happen.
She spins one panel of the cube and then, thinking better of it, spins it right back into place, as if not wanting to spoil its perfection. She slides it back where she found it on the nightstand.
I should probably apologize about my mom emailing you.
I told her not to. Zoe looks up.
I don't imagine you found what you wanted.
I shake my head.
I didn't think so. My mom's clueless when it comes to that stuff. She never knew when my brother was high. He'd be talking so slow and she'd be like, he's just tired.
She pauses and stares at the Rubik's Cube.
Why did he say that?
It's almost a whisper.
She's lost me.
In his note, she says,
because there's Zoe. And all my hope is pinned on Zoe, who I don't even know and who doesn't know me. Why would he write that? What does that even mean?
Oh.
The letter. She has the letter memorized.
She stares at me, waiting for a response. When I don't provide one, her head drops and her legs angle away. I recognize that feeling. When your body tries to fold in on itself in the hopes that it can go unseen.
I can't stand to see her like this. So in need.
Maybe, I say. I mean, I'm not 100% sure about this, but thinking about it now, Connor always felt like, you know, if you guys were just closer.
We weren't close, Zoe says. At all.
No, I know. But he used to say that he wished you were. He wanted you to be. Her chin comes up. Just like that, she seems resuscitated. So you and Connor, you guys would talk about me? Oh, yeah, definitely. Sometimes. I mean, if he brought it up. I never brought it up, obviously. Why would I have brought it up? But yeah, he totally thought you were awesome. She smells something foul. He thought I was awesome? My brother? Yeah, of course. I mean, maybe he didn't use that exact word, but how? How did he think you were awesome? Yeah, she says, pulling up her knees and sitting cross-legged on the bed. I gulp, hopefully not audibly. Well, okay. Let me try to remember. Oh, okay. How Zoe is awesome happens to be a subject I know a lot about. So, whenever you have a solo in jazz band, you close your eyes. You probably don't even know that you're doing this, but you get this half-smile, like you just heard the funniest thing in the world, but it's a secret and you can't tell anyone. But the way you smile, it's sort of like you're letting us in on the secret, too. Do I do that? Totally. At least that's what Connor told me. I never knew he was even awake at any of my concerts. My parents always made him go. I laugh, like, of course he was awake. That is so funny and ridiculous what you just said. She looks down and scratches the stitching in Connor's quilt. I did it again. I took it too far. I shouldn't be doing this, digging myself in deeper when the whole reason I came here was to finally break free. Just tell her. Do it. Now. You know, the first time he ever said anything nice about me was in his note, Zoe says. A note he wrote to you. He couldn't even say it to me. Oh, well, he wanted to. He couldn't. She takes it in for a long moment. Shyly, she asks, did he say anything else about me? How do I answer this question? Before I can formulate a response, she jumps back in. Never mind, I don't even care. No, it's not that, it's just, he said so many things about you. She peeks up, her eyes move through me. What am I doing? I know he thought you looked really pretty. I mean, sorry, what I meant to say is that he thought it was pretty cool when you dyed your hair blue. Really? She stares into space, seeming to travel back in time to sophomore year when her hair had lines of blue in it. That's weird because he used to make fun of me all the time. Well, he liked to tease you. You know that. Yeah, she says, nodding to herself. He noticed all kinds of things about you. He'd watch you all the time, just keeping track of you, I guess. Again, I have her full attention. He noticed how you scribble on the cuffs of your jeans when you get bored. A sheepish smile. I finally cross the divide between us and sit down on the bed, facing her. And how you chew on the caps of your pens, and how your forehead crinkles when you're mad. I didn't think he paid any attention to me. Oh, he did. He couldn't not pay attention to you. She seems troubled. I just wish I knew. I take a hefty breath. I know, it's just, he didn't know how to say all this to you. He didn't know how to tell you that he was your biggest fan. No one was a bigger fan than him. He knew how great you are. Her eyes, looking into mine. You are so great, Zoe. Freckled nose. I can't even tell you. Shimmery hair. I mean it. Lips like pink pillows. Smiling at me. You're everything. I feel them, even softer than I imagined. Her hand on my chest, pushing me back. What are you doing? Zoe says. I can't speak words. What the hell am I doing? She jumps up, forehead crinkled, staring, processing. I'm sorry, I didn't mean... Dinner's ready, Cynthia yells from downstairs. I see Zoe's anger, confusion, hurt, all these emotions arriving at once because of me. Tell them to eat without me. She's out the door before I can stop her, before I can clean up this brand new mess I've made.
You what?
Is it that bad?
You tried to kiss Zoe Murphy on her brother's bed after he died.
It looks really bad when you type it out like that.
Grapefruits. Your balls are the size of grapefruits. How do you walk around with those things in your pants?
I didn't mean to do it. It just happened. I just got caught up in the moment. It felt like she, like we, like something was happening. When I leaned in, it was as if my body was working without my mind, like we were being drawn together. I don't know how long I sat on Connor's bed before Cynthia appeared at the door announcing for the second time that dinner was ready. It could have been 2 seconds or 20 minutes. I thought about jumping out the window, just one story down. I could have made it. I've survived falls from greater heights. I could have disappeared into the night and never looked back. Somehow I willed myself off that bed and down those stairs and sat at that table. When Zoe didn't show up, I suggested to her parents that she probably wasn't feeling well. As expected, over a home-cooked meal, the likes of which I've never seen in my house, Cynthia asked if I happened to find anything in the emails. Larry seemed annoyed that she was even bringing it up. As they bickered, I reminded myself that this was my chance to come clean. At least I wouldn't have to do it in front of Zoe, which was a small but not insignificant relief. I desperately wanted to. My stomach was a hot puddle of nerves, had been for a week straight. I couldn't take it anymore. But to get rid of it once and for all, I had to do the brave thing. That's where my plan failed. I couldn't do it. I'm not brave. I'm extremely not brave. Being not brave is just about as easy as breathing. Here's how I did it. First I shook my head. Then I said, I didn't find anything. That was it. The moment passed. Connor's parents were content to move on to another topic, and so was I. I can't remember what the new topic was. It hardly mattered. Eventually, we returned to the topic of Connor. They asked me questions. I told them what I thought they wanted to hear, what I thought would make them happy. I wish someone could do the same for me.
Chapter 13. On the bus to school, I write a new letter for Dr. Sherman. Dear Evan Hansen, today is going to be a good day, and here's why. Because it isn't supposed to rain like yesterday, and that's good because I didn't have to pack my umbrella and my backpack feels a little lighter. Sincerely, me. It's short and underwhelming, but factual. If Dr. Sherman asks me about it at our session today, at least I'll be able to stand behind it as the honest truth. I'm done being ambitious. Jared was wrong. My balls aren't grapefruits. If ball size equates to confidence, then I've got the smallest ones you can have and still qualify as a man. My balls are poppy seeds. It's been 4 days since I tried to kiss Zoe Murphy. I mean, I did kiss her. It was just really brief and she didn't reciprocate, but it did, in fact, happen. I wish it hadn't, but it did. It was only my third kiss ever, and my first two barely counted as kisses. Pretty depressing when you consider I'm old enough to drive a car and donate blood and get my own passport. My first kiss was with Robin, who lived in the one-story home across the street. It happened in her pool. It was a lightning-speed peck, more funny than anything, just because we both wanted to find out what it felt like. And my second kiss was from Amy Brodsky when I was 10. She just leaned over at recess one day, and I instantly fell in love with her. Until I saw her do the exact same thing to two other boys over the course of the next week. I haven't been the same since kissing Zoe. I can't eat, or sleep, or think. I try to read, but the lines in books start to vibrate and turn blurry. I put on movies, but I can't pay attention to what's happening on screen. When my mom gets home from work at night, I pretend I'm already asleep, but really I'm just lying there in the dark. I can't even stand being on the computer. I'm too worried I'll find a new email from the Murphys asking me to come over for another dinner or send them more emails, or both. They haven't contacted me since I saw them the other night. Maybe they finally have what they need. Maybe they're done with me.
That's what I wanted, right?
I've been telling myself that.
Then why am I sitting here now feeling something that seems awfully similar to disappointment?
The plan, if there ever was a plan, was to offer the Murphys solace in whatever way I could, and then for me to go back to living my normal life. But now, after everything, that just doesn't feel right.
The bus bumps along.
I picture, for a moment, the driver steering us off a cliff. Unfortunately, there are no cliffs in town. Maybe she could drive us off Xavier Bridge instead. Or take us under an overpass that's too low. Trouble over. The small comfort I get from this brief death fantasy is outsized by my guilt. I shouldn't be daring mortality. Connor Murphy is actually dead, and I'm sitting here pretending like I want to be. I don't want to be dead. I'm finally sure of that. I just wish that life, for once, for a day or even a few hours, would go smoothly. I can never just sit back and sail. People like rocks can put their feet up and let the water carry them along. Not me. I'm constantly on the verge of sinking. The bus jerks to a stop and we all file out. Thankfully, I haven't seen Zoe at school. I've tried to avoid her and I think she's done the same with me. Still, I keep fearing I'll turn the corner and she'll be there. You want to know what's really fun? When your nerves are so fried that the sweat from your hand drips down your pen and onto your paper, making the surface so moist that the next time you try to write a word, you accidentally shred the paper with the tip of your pen. It's the best. I'm too wrapped up in my own thoughts to notice the commotion up ahead. Students step aside to make way for the freight train that is Miss Bortle. She's coming at a clip, a cardboard box in her chiseled arms. Chasing behind is Principal Howard.
You're making this worse, Bonnie. That's school property.
This is my stuff. Bonnie, please.
Miss Bortle turns to face Principal Howard.
John, get ready, because I'm suing your ass.
Our collective jaws drop as Miss Bortle strides into the parking lot and into her black sports car. Principal Howard, donning a professional smile, encourages us to keep moving. But we can't unsee what we just saw. What did we just see? Already, yesterday, I noticed that there weren't as many people staring at me during lunch compared with when the news first broke about Connor and me. Now it's down to a few passing glances. Those few glances may not even be aimed my way. It's hard to tell. As I'm inspecting the room, as surreptitiously as I can, I spot Sam, my fellow lonely loner. Except he's seated at a table across the cafeteria. The last few days he sat at my table. We even chatted a little bit. Meaning, we said hey to each other a few times. I figured we were the same kind of person. We both pack lunches from home, we both prefer to keep to ourselves, we both have nowhere better to sit in the cafeteria. Turns out I was wrong about the last one. Apparently, even Sam has options. I return to my sandwich. Again, that disappointed feeling. This is the existence I'm used to, being overlooked. I didn't want people staring at me while I eat my lunch. I should feel relieved right now, shouldn't I? I guess, as uncomfortable as I felt being watched, it was also kinda nice, for a change, to actually be seen. I wonder how Connor Murphy got through lunch each day. Where did he sit? With whom? What did he eat? I never paid attention. Just like no one's paying attention to me. I take out my phone, just to have something to do. I scroll past everything. Most of the news is about a celebrity sex scandal or an upcoming election. There's a big movie coming out this weekend that I'm interested in, but it's the third installment in a trilogy and I still haven't seen the first two. I'm surrounded by voices, hundreds of them, and these voices combine to form a wall. I can't break through the wall. This, what I hold in my hand, is the only way inside, the only way I can learn what's going on in my own world. According to my phone, the major news at school, unsurprisingly, centers on one single name. It's just not the name I've grown accustomed to seeing. I shut my locker and Alana Beck is waiting there. My ribcage does its best to hold back my skittish heart.
Jesus, you scared me, I say.
I need to show you something.
Every time Alana opens her mouth, I feel like I'm being scolded.
She dresses like she's the dean of a small liberal arts college, and she probably could be. Not only does she relish following the rules, but she's also the only one who even knows what they are. Her backpack sucker punches me as she does an about-face. I follow her down the hall. We stop in front of a trash can, and Alana points inside. Resting on top of a pile of debris is one of the Connor Murphy pins that Jared was selling.
"It's the third one I've found," Alana says. "The first one was on the ground in the parking lot. Someone apparently ran it over with their car. And there was another one in the toilet in the girls' bathroom."
"That can't be good for plumbing."
"Why are you showing me this?" I say.
"I was already noticing that people were mentioning Connor less, and now this. People don't care anymore. All anyone wants to talk about is Miss Bortle. Some people are saying she slept with a student, but I also heard she might have had an affair with Principal Howard."
"No way."
She shakes her head at the shame of it. "People have totally forgotten about Connor Murphy. You can't let this happen, Evan. You were Connor's best friend."
It doesn't sound so crazy to hear Alana say that. I mean, it's not true, I know. But also, when you think about it, it might be kind of true. There's a good possibility that I was the last person Connor spoke to the day he died. We had an authentic exchange. For guys like Connor and me, that type of interaction is rare, and it definitely forged a bond between us. I'm probably the only one who had any clue how he was truly feeling that day. Who else besides me, and maybe Alana, even thought about him for a second in the last week? No one. Seriously, as absurd as it sounds, is there anyone in this entire school who was closer to Connor than I was?
"Maybe you can ask Zoe to do something," Alana says.
Okay, obviously I wasn't counting Zoe.
"Zoe is the perfect person to help get people interested again," Alana says. "She was literally his sister."
"I'm sorry, I can't. I just don't think that's the best way for us to get people to remember him."
Alana gives me a look that reduces me to half my size.
"Well, I guarantee that if you don't do something, no one will remember Connor. Is that what you want?"
She hurries off without waiting for a response. I look down at Connor's face in the trash. I don't want it to be this way either, but what am I supposed to do? I bite my nails as Dr. Sherman reads over my letter. The few strands of hair on top of his head resemble cracks in a wall. One of the reasons my mom chose Dr. Sherman, other than the fact that he was covered by her health insurance, was because he's young. He looks old to me, but my mom says he's only 30. Dr. Sherman hands back my laptop. I snap it shut and wait for him to say something. Typically, that can take a while. Dr. Sherman prefers that I do the talking. I do not share his preference. Sometimes I feel like we're playing a game of chicken, each waiting for the other to utter the first word. In normal social situations, I can't stand silence, but here I get a slight thrill from seeing how long I can stretch it out. I think my ideal session would include only hello and goodbye. I'm not trying to waste Dr. Sherman's time, it's nothing against him. I just have this feeling sometimes that even the best therapist in the world couldn't fix me. A few minutes later, Dr. Sherman gives in. "How's your day been so far?" "Let's see. Not amazing? Not good? Not terrible?" In some ways, it was exactly like so many other days of my life, and in other ways, vastly different. So much has happened, and so fast. I just wish I could slow everything down somehow. Because it's unfair how the world keeps on going no matter what happens, and people like Connor just get left behind. Literally one day he's pinned over someone's heart and the next he's tossed in the garbage. How can that be? I think myself into such a twister that it's no wonder some of my thoughts start flying right out of my mouth. "It's just not right." I look up, shocked by my own voice. I feel this sudden sense of relief, having said only that much. I want to release more. I can't share all of it, but there's plenty I can say. I give in to the temptation. I tell Dr. Sherman about Connor Murphy, how he died and how everyone was talking about him for a while, how they seemed to care one minute and now they don't care anymore because they're onto something new. "And this bothers you?" Dr. Sherman asks.
"Well, yeah," I say. "It does. I don't think it's right to just brush someone aside like that. One minute they care about him and the next they don't. It's like he's just being... forgotten." Dr. Sherman shifts in his chair.
I notice he does this when he feels we finally hit on something that deserves more exploration. I glance up at the